What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast Case Studies with Kathy, and we're also joined by her longtime friend, Thomas Petmecki. Kathy and Thomas went to college together at Southwest Texas State University, which is now Texas State University, and they have close to 70 years combined experience. If you throw me in, then it gets over 70, all right? So they have a lot of stories, a lot of experience, a lot of things where you have to look back and say, you know, there was something odd about that situation. What was it? It wasn't normal. It wasn't just the clear-cut ACL. It was something just slightly different. So that's what we want to hear about, things that you really only learn with experience, with having that situation come up. And so that's why we got you guys here to talk about just some of the strange things that you've seen. I'm the host, Jeremy Jackson, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/casestudieskathy. Case Studies Kathy is this episode. So you got sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, and I'll type in as much of the notes as I can as they're talking, and then there'll be links and stuff there at the end. So without much further ado, Thomas, let's get to your AT story. So how did you get to where you are there? You said you're 33 years at Smithson Valley, but what led you up to Smithson Valley?
Well, I actually started in high school. I was a vertically challenged individual. And so I was on the freshman football team, and I went in there and told the coaches that I really thought I could help out the team a whole lot better if I was a person who could tape and take care of injuries, and did that the rest of my high school career, went to Southwest Texas, and, you know, it was a thing kind of where I didn't know really what else to do, you know, didn't really have a career, wasn't going to follow in my father's shoes or anything like that, do the family business. So thought, well, this is a way to stay in touch with athletics, you know, which I loved. I wasn't very good at it, but, you know, I had a chance to stay around there, and it was fun. And, you know, I got into the program there at Southwest Texas, got some knowledge, got out, and I did 1 year up at Marcus High School up in Louisville. And then I took the job down here, and this was just kind of going to be a way station on the way until I figured out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I guess I still haven't figured that part out.
All right. So 1 year other than Smithson Valley, started in high school, Texas State University, or Southwest Texas then. Very good. You said it was after your freshman year of high school, or like during your freshman year?
I went through two-a-days in football. And at the little school I was at, San Saba, the Fighting Armadillos, we only had a freshman team and a varsity team. So freshmen all during two-a-days were lined up against the seniors and going through tackling drills, etc. So I don't know how many concussions I have from my playing days just from those 2 weeks of two-a-days, but I kind of figured out about the start of school that there was probably something else I could do to really help out the team other than just be a speed bump that everybody rolled over.
All right, so how did you figure out, hey, let me try and take care of them medically? Did you guys have an athletic training staff there?
No, we had a young man by the name of Charles Miffleton that he went to all the Kramer clinics whenever he was growing up. And so, you know, we had a coach who was in charge of being the athletic trainer. You know, he was in charge of that. But half the time, the athletes would just skip him and go straight over to Miffleton, you know. And so he was in there. He had, like I said, been to the Kramer clinics, and he knew that, you know, how to do a lot of basic stuff. He knew a lot of the anatomy. And then, you know, at the same time, his folks had a ranch. So he had, you know, done a lot of veterinarian work, and he knew some things about fixing animals up. So he just applied it over to humans.
All right. So just by hanging out with, you said, Charles Mickelson, you kind of decided you can better serve the team. And then how did you make that jump from there to athletic training at Southwest Texas?
Well, I had a high school coach, Jeff Henry, who came in, and he said, hey, this is something that I bet you'd be good at this, at being an athletic trainer. You know, this is a profession that's taking off. And so he was a big influence for me. You know, he said, I think this is something that you would be good at. And at the same time, my uncle, who was coaching out in Monahans, he had his old Klaus and Arnheim book. He still had it from college. And so he threw it over my direction, and I started looking at that and started reading that, was interested in what was there. So I went ahead and started looking at that, you know, maybe being something that I could do. And I wound up going to the Kramer clinics that they were holding at Southwest Texas back between my junior and senior year of high school.
All right. Very good. It's funny because Bill has a story similar. He was in like eighth grade, he was playing sports and said, oh, wait, never mind. And he kind of told the coach here, I'll just tape ankles, and went to a Kramer clinic and learned that there was no athletic trainer program. I think he said there was one at the stadium that he went and learned some stuff from, but it was nothing like what we have here in Pasadena. And I know other parts of the country, they don't have athletic trainers and that kind of thing. So it's just fun to hear the stories of how people got to where they are. So I know, Kathy, you've shared your story before on the listener spotlight, but why don't you go ahead and give us some of your background here?
I'd be glad to. And I actually, first athletic trainer I really knew was somebody that actually was a relative. I grew up in Hondo, Texas, that was the athletic trainer, John Zare, who actually recently passed away. He kind of doctored everybody up. But I actually went to high school at Austin Westlake, and we did not have an athletic trainer, which many people are surprised. When I was in high school, I got hurt playing basketball, and my high school coach, it was Kathy Self, who's at Duncanville now, and she I couldn't finish playing my senior year, and so she goes, well, you might as well help us do something. So she taught me to tape ankles, and which really wasn't very good. She really is a better coach than she is an athletic trainer. And she had played at UT, so for career day, she arranged for me to go down and spend the day with the University of Texas Athletic Trainers, which then UT had divided athletic training rooms, so I spent the day with the female athletic trainers. And I thought, well, you know, this may be something I could do. At that time, the head female athletic trainer was Becky Bluedow Marshall. And at the end of my day, I visited with her, and she said, you know, if you really want to do this, you know, we don't... you know, you can get into UT, which I had already been accepted. She said, you know, you're just going to deal with the female athletes. She goes, but if you want to do this as the high school setting, she goes, I suggest you go down the road to Southwest Texas because they have a co-ed program, which was one of the few in the state at that time. She goes, you need some experience with football, because I had not worked football in high school. And she wrote down on a sheet of paper, I'll never forget this, she goes, you need to talk to this guy named Dr. Bobby Patton. And I hadn't even applied to Southwest Texas, so I had to apply, and I got in, and I went down and talked to Dr. Patton, and, you know, the rest is history. So had she not, my coach not taken an interest in me and set up a day with UT and then talked to Becky Bluedow Marshall, I wouldn't have ended up at Southwest Texas and met Thomas Petmicki.
There you go, and the rest is history. It's strange how just such a few things kind of change the course of everything. We were just talking about my career. I had three different athletic trainers when I was in high school and four different during my 5 years in college. And one that I was in high school, it was Joe Martinez, and he worked or knew Robert Platt, who was my head athletic trainer at Houston Baptist. And he was like, hey, call this guy. They're looking for somebody that have a full scholarship. Other than that, I was planning on going to Lamar University, and, you know, everything would have been different had I done that. So just such small things, like you said, your coach or that the lady there at UT saying, hey, I care more about you than you being part of our program. And so she sent you on down the road to somewhere where you could do better for yourself professionally. So such a cool story.
Well, I think it's also important that every time, you know, I meet a student or, you know, they need some help being introduced, I never hesitate because somebody took time to help me out. So I think that's important to pay it forward, you know, for somebody coming behind us.
Very good. All right. So here is the kind of the meat of the content here. We're talking about things that you have seen that cause you to second guess or to look or have to call somebody or maybe look it up in a reference book and say, hey, this thing is just not right. So what are some of the stories that you guys have of strange things in athletic training?
Well, Thomas, you probably remember this better than I do. I was telling Jeremy about when we were in college, and we had the football player. I know that he has passed away, but the football player that couldn't catch his breath, and they did a chest x-ray. And I don't know about you, but I was standing outside the exam room when they slid his x-ray up, and I'll never forget what it looked like. You want to go ahead and tell that story?
Basically, they went in there and found a huge tumor is what I remember of that, you know. And but, you know, Toad, isn't that what we called him?
Yeah.
Toad?
Yeah.
Yeah, Toad was... he was a fighter. He was one of these guys that it didn't matter. He was going to do what it took to make it back. And he went through the treatments and I mean, he was an inspiration just on the sidelines to the other players, because they, you know, they may be having a hard time. It's, you know, 100 degrees and they're sweating all over the place, but they look over there and see him and realize, you know, he's not just fighting to catch his breath. He's fighting for his life. And I personally got some inspiration from him, because he had a positive outlook. He was always pushing on, and he came back. He wound up playing again.
Yeah, he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And actually went through treatment at MD Anderson. Now, remember, this was in the early 80s. And, you know, I really just thought he had some kind of pneumonia, and he had a huge mass in his chest. So, you know, that's one of those things that you never expect as a student athletic trainer in college, to have a player who was in top physical condition. And we just won, one national championship. And you have one of your linemen come down with that. So I think that was our first introduction to this is an unexpected something. And, you know.
Something out of the normal realm that you don't see every day, that, you know, you've got to look at other things. Whenever it looks like it's just a normal this, that, or the other, sometimes there's another explanation for what's going on.
All right. So were you guys involved in the evaluation and leading up to the chest x-ray?
No, but we had our team doctor, you know, they came in, they sent him to the San Marcos Hospital for x-rays, but his follow-up, actually one of our colleagues, Mark Salter, who has passed away, Mark actually drove him to his chemo treatments, if I remember correctly. And, but just being around and seeing the, you know, it was kind of a small school then, but okay, from the evaluation to the diagnosis to, okay, we're going to take treatment right now, and his follow-through, I think, was very eye-opening at our early age. I mean, you know, we're all 20, 19 and 20. So I think at that point we learned you really can't take these symptoms, which look like bronchitis or, you know, pneumonia, for granted. I think that's was eye-opening for me. Never forgot that.
I love that. There's so many times that you'll see an athletic trainer saying, you know, suck it up, buttercup, that kind of thing. Like there's a time and a place, but our job is really to help that kid get better, help that athlete get better, whatever their situation is, whether it's a mental injury or a physical injury. And we just have to slow down and look, hey, this kid is important. This is somebody's child. This is somebody's something. You know, you don't know what's going on. And so it's such a good reminder from you guys to remember to look at it. It could be something else. It could be life altering. And so, all right.
I think the big take home message, I don't know, but here was somebody who was our age. I think that's what hit home is mm-hmm. it, when you're dealing with somebody who could be your brother or your sister and they have cancer, I think that's what was most shocking to us, you know, because remember we were students mm-hmm. as well. So,
all right. So besides seeing your classmate with lymphoma, what are some of the other strange or unusual things that you guys have seen through the years?
Just the kids who come in that already have some type of problem whenever they come into our program, you know, whenever they come into high school, that pre-existing conditions that you've got to be aware of. I mean, we're seeing more and more of the things that where kids are coming in with diabetes or other situations like that. But sometimes it's an orthopedic thing as well. We had a kid several years ago that came in, and he's signing his name on the paperwork, and I look at him, and his ring finger is bent over. I mean, it's coming around where it's touching the first finger. It's all the way over like that, and that's just sitting there normal for him. And find out that whenever he was younger, he had been shot with a .22, had gone through the finger there, didn't have a whole lot of medical insurance or whatever, for whatever reason. They just kind of patched up the wound and let him go. And so he had that finger always been around. And, you know, over the years, he wound up catching it two or three times. And, you know, it got been around. And we tried to do some things to kind of pad him up, protect him, take care of that pre-existing condition. But it was not something that he was comfortable with doing. He would rather just go ahead and try to, you know, use that thing normal. And it was just something that, you know, we had to deal with.
All right. Internally rotated pinky finger from a gunshot that was never properly treated. And again, mm-hmm. you said that became normal for him. So using it some way other than normal caused problems, right? So you go looking
right.
at
yeah,
pre-existing conditions.
Right. Yeah. We're, you know, and trying to do something where we protected it, you know, try to buddy tape or something like that. It didn't go there.
Go ahead, Kathy, what you got?
I think the most important thing is, I hate to stay on this one topic, but especially, I don't know if it's where we live, but, you know, having what we think is also a routine injury and a wound that doesn't heal, okay? I, many years back, had an athlete who, I have to be careful with identifying information here, had an athlete who had a injury to lower extremity and, you know, just didn't heal and sent her to orthopedic and x-rays show that she had a tumor on her foot, and it turns out it was malignant. And so, you know, I think that you know, you never suspect that in a teenager, that you know, a kid that could go on, and she went on to, you know, play Division I ball, that they would have cancerous growth on their foot. So it goes back to what we were talking about when we were in college, is, you know, it presented as something that we normally would see. But I think you have to not dismiss even the simplest injuries. You know, sometimes we're like, yeah, just put some ice on it. But I think you have to look at every athlete, look at the family history, because that's real important, especially, I think, where we live down here on the coast. You know, there's maybe a little bit higher rate of cancer down here, and that family history is really important. When you see wounds that don't heal, you know, a lump or it's red or that, you really have to get it investigated, because it can turn into something that, you know, could be quite serious. And, you know, I saw that firsthand, you know, about 15 years ago. So that's real important. But this, you know, worked out for this young lady, and they were able to take care of it. So that's one thing that I learned. It's very important, and I never forgot that. So that's one thing that we got. And, you know, no matter where you live, but that's one of the things that's very important down here, especially.
One of the things that I try to do with my athletes is I say, okay, we're going to treat it like this for a week. If we don't see it getting any better, mm-hmm. or if it's getting worse, then we're going to mm-hmm. send you to the doctor.
Right.
Right. And so that way it gives them an idea, hey, we're not going to just keep doing the same thing over and over.
Right.
If it's not changing, or right. if it's getting worse, we're going to send you on somewhere else to someone, right. so somebody else can take right. a look and see if you can get
right.
it fixed. And so that's a good practice, just saying, giving them a time frame, giving them mm-hmm. an idea of where they're
right.
headed, and
right.
then sending them on. And then right. that can help identify those problems without going 6 weeks, 6 months, and be like, oh, well, sorry, I just never referred them.
Right, right. And, you know, that's the thing. I think we kind of talked about this individually, but the family history, you know, sometimes the kids fill it out on the PPE, but that's really important, especially we're seeing more and more kids that are hypertensive, but that's really important because it, you know, has effects on many other things when they're, you know, during athletics. But anyway, I'll yield to Mr. Petmecki for another story.
Another story, huh? Well, I guess other thing, another one that you don't really talk about, or I mean, we talk about that track, we talk about hamstring pulls and, you know, things like that. But 1 year we were out here and we actually had one of the parents got, you know, you put out around the vector lines for the track meet for round discus and shot put and everything like that. And we had a parent who was warned several times, stay back behind that. And they got out close to one of the sector lines and they actually caught a discus in the head. And, you know, it was grave. They wound up bringing in the air life paramedics, actually wound up picking up this guy. And it was a thing where, you know, I'm over at one part of the track meet and all of a sudden air, you know, just kind of this wave of people screaming my name and everything. And it's not something that you're thinking of, you know, over there by shot and discus. It's, you know, you've got something, you've got a spectator or somebody like that that's been hurt, but you know, that's somebody else that you got to worry about. That's why we put up things to try to keep people back in their area and out of the way and keep them out of harm. But you know, people jump out there and every year, you know, we run into somebody else. We start talking to them, you know, hey, y'all need to stay back. Well, hey, I'm trying to take a picture of my kid. And I'll tell them, you know, We've had a guy that wanted to just take a picture of his kid, and it almost cost him his life. So
you said he caught a discus in the face.
Right above the eyebrows. It caught him right there. He had an open fracture. I came up there, and there was a coach, had a hand across his forehead, and so he kind of said, well, what do I do with this? And pulled his hand out, and you could start to see it kind of sloshing out. And so I said, well, put your hand back on it. Yeah.
hold simple that solution.
Tight, you know, and so and he did. You know, this is back in the days before cell phones. So, you know, we got to right quick find some way to communicate to EMS what's going on. And luckily, around that time period, I had been helping out. I'd been running with our EMS out here. And so I happened to have an EMS radio on me. And so I called up and knew the paramedic who was on duty. And I told her, hey, you better get AirLife in the air now. And y'all need to be over here, too. You know, y'all are about to get toned out. We've got a major situation going on here. But, you know, nowadays, we don't even think about, you know, with everybody's got a cell phone. You know, you don't think about such things as far as communication. And, you know, that's a thing that nowadays we don't have a problem with. But back then, there was definitely a problem. You know, I remember the old steps of going through, what do you do in an emergency situation, that we went through with our student trainers. And we would always identify, you know, in this situation, you know, which student trainer was going to go and make the phone call. And we would practice what you're going to say when you're online with the people on 911. And it was, you know, a different time. But luckily for this guy, we happened to have some extra communication, and we got him taken care of. And, you know, where nobody was giving him a chance, he wound up pulling through.
When I was in my first year as a professional, I worked at I was the assistant, and we just happened to both be there after school. I don't know if it was a track practice or track meet, but there was a girl that either got a discus or a shot put like to the top of the head, and I think it just skinned her. But I don't really remember how we took care of it. Like, I remember going with him, and he did most of the care and the call and that kind of stuff. But I mean, that's not the first time I've heard about a shot put or discus harming somebody.
Yeah, and you know, there's been other cases where, or times I've been around, that, you know, somebody called a shot put or something wrong. You know, in college we had one where they were doing warm up, and everybody was just going real quick, trying to warm up quickly, and they're throwing it out there, and one girl caught the shot put right between the shoulder blades, right on the spine. And somebody else was there. I ran off to go get the athletic trainers that were on site, and whenever we got back over there, the coach was over there picking the kid up, and come on, get out of the way. Everybody else is trying to warm up. We're behind up here, you know. And luckily, everything turned out all right with that kid. You know, they got her off to the side and evaluated. But, you know, it things like that happen, you know, more often than you'd think.
We had, and this really has to do with athletic trainers. And, you know, this time of year, we're trying to cover multiple events, and we're on motorized vehicles, you know, Gator or whatever you're on. And this actually happened to athletic trainer that I worked with, and she was covering multiple sites, and she was going across a parking lot on a Gator, and she had just crossed this lot, and she was going back across, and somebody had come back and put a chain across it. She didn't see it at night, and that chain come across the Gator, hit the, and it caught her right here, and you know, it could have killed her. But, you know, luckily, emergency response and getting her to the right hospital saved her life. But it's a reminder that, you know, this time of year, we're in a hurry to get between fields, that you've got to make sure that when you're driving, or anybody who's driving a motorized vehicle on a school campus, that you're crossing, you think that gate's open, or wherever there's a chain, that you take your time, because, you know, anytime you're using, whether it's a Gator or whatever motor, be careful, because it can, you know, they are, you know, it is a motorized vehicle or electric vehicle, they can become deadly very quickly.
A similar story that I know of, the athletic trainer, they had students driving the golf cart or the Gator, and for some reason or another, they kind of went off a ditch and pinned the athlete into the ditch with the Gator and ended up killing the athlete. And so that's part of the reason we've chosen not to allow athletes to drive our golf cart, mm-hmm. because a situation like that, you know, if I was to do that, then, you know, mm-hmm. I can deal with it. I can handle it. And I work through the school. It's a completely different situation than if I let a student
right.
do that.
Right.
And so definitely got to be careful again with the motorized vehicles, like you said.
Our district has a policy against that because we have had a couple of instances where student trainers have hit somebody, hit a band member or something like that after a game. And so our district has a policy against it. And, you know, it's been a thing that my senior student trainers will go, hey, I've got my driver's license. I've got all of this. And I know, I understand. And the kid who had that wreck all those years ago, he had his driver's license too. But now it's the way it's worded is they have to be an employee of the school district. So we have that policy in effect.
I don't know if it's an unusual injury, but, you know, most softball dugouts and baseball dugouts are open. And so an overthrow, depends on if you're the home team or not, overthrow from first or third goes right into the dugout. And I actually had a student trainer that wasn't paying attention and got hit in the head with an overthrow. And, you know, it was a pretty serious head injury. And it was just a matter of not paying attention, as, you know, you said. So, you know, we are there to take care of the athletes, and our student aides are there. But, you know, spring sports, you got to be careful. You have track and you have discus and softball and baseball. You have to be aware when you're in an area that is not an open dugout, especially baseball and softball, because an overthrow into the dugout, you know, is very dangerous. You have to be paying attention at all times. I mean, it could have been fatal because it was a very hard throw at a short distance, and luckily she survived.
I have a similar story where I was in college wrapping an ice bag around a pitcher, so in my back to the field, thump, like right in the back of the calf, and not in my head, but yeah, just same thing. It's not that I wasn't paying attention to the game. I was doing what I was supposed to. That's why I always tell my students, watch out, always keep an eye at the game so you can at least see what's going on over there, because I've personally been a victim to that type of thing. So,
well, we've been setting up in the dugout, putting up water or whatever, and the coach goes, well, it works better down there at that other end. I said, yeah, but if they're down at that other end, they've got their back to the batter. We've just recently had our dugouts redone where they at least have a half concrete wall now. In the past, they've been completely open, and there for a while, we had some batters that whenever I sat in the dugout, I had a glove on because the ball would come, they'd turn on that thing a little bit too quick and they'd shoot it straight into the dugout. And, you know, it was now at that half wall, at least we've got a little bit more protection, but ours are open like that as well. And, you know, just the simple thing, like you said, you know, you're wrapping somebody up, you're getting a drink of water, you know, you're doing something like that. You know, you got to do things to try to make it where people have a chance, you know, to be a little bit protected and set up your dugout, set up where you're at, making sure the student trainers aren't, you know, sitting there on the phone doing things like that. They need to be paying attention because it's a live situation there. It's not like being at football where you're back, you know, 10 yards off the field. You know, they're right in the middle of it there, especially with baseball and softball.
I had an usual situation many years back, before AEDs were readily available. I actually had walked I had an office over at the hospital, and just picked something up out of my office, and at our fitness center, was open on a Saturday, and the only person there was myself and the fitness coordinator, and we have a fitness center that's open to the public. And she yelled for me to come help her that one of the fitness members had fallen off a treadmill. So I went over to assist the person, and looks like he was having a seizure. So I told her to, you know, go through the emergency procedure, which was called 911 because we're not part of the hospital. And then he stopped breathing on me. And turns out he was having a heart attack. But I couldn't figure out why this man was in a suit. He was in a suit on a treadmill. And so she was on the phone, and, you know, EMS wasn't going to send anybody because she was on the phone for a very long time. Turns out, you know, caller ID showed that we were a hospital, and they didn't know why a hospital needed EMS. And so that delayed her. I didn't have an AED. And so, you know, I started CPR on this guy. And I didn't have a mouth shield. That's the last time I'll go someplace without a mouth shield. But one of the fitness members that had been working out, said, you know, I learned CPR last week at work, but I don't know how to do two man. So between the two of us, we gave this guy CPR, and finally help arrived. And he ended up surviving. So the lesson in that is never go anywhere without a CPR shield. They have AEDs everywhere. It turns out that he was a professional organist, and he had played a wedding that morning, and so he started feeling bad, so he thought he'd go work out. That's why he had a suit on. But, you know, you never think you're going to walk into your office and see somebody having a seizure and then go into cardiac arrest. So, and, you know, the good Lord takes care of you and has somebody who just learned CPR the week before. So as unusual as it is, and we're all trained in CPR, you never know when you're going to use it. So that's an unusual story. So I keep a face mask shield on all my keychains in case you ever need it.
Right. We've had two different students that had pacemakers, defibs in the chest that has both collapsed on campus. One of them, while I was teaching world history, and somebody opened up my door right quick and said, "We got somebody who needs you right quick." And luckily, I was right by the stairwell, and they were at the top of the stairs. And I went up there, and our school nurse was already trying to start CPR on the kid. He had been with a class that, and their education or their physical education for the day was they were just walking the hall. And walking up up in that area, the pacemaker stopped, and he collapsed. We did CPR on him, and it was not successful. And within a year, we had a second kid who had the same situation, and he collapsed. He survived, but yes, again, that was back before we had AEDs. You did the CPR, and that was what we had.
All right, so that's a question I've kind of come across, a student with a pacemaker. Did either of those students play sports?
No. Mm-mm. They were in a modified, like I said, modified PE class, where they were just walking the hall.
Okay. All right. So have you ever come across a student playing sports with a pacemaker, Kathy, Thomas?
I don't think so. I haven't.
Right. That's something I'm to find out more about. I know somebody mentioned that on one of the online things. So I just need to find out what you would do with the student in that situation. What are they cleared to do? What are they not cleared to do? And I'm pretty sure they would know, but I'm pretty sure it would also come with a note from a cardiologist saying they're cleared with a pacemaker kind of thing. So.
No, I don't think I ever have. You know, I've had one with a missing organ, like a missing kidney, play soccer, which always made me a little nervous, but they were cleared, you know. Just wore like a quarterback flak jacket under their soccer uniform and played 4 years. Not a problem.
Yeah, we had a kid that was playing football and got a blow to the lower back and went in, and trying to figure out what was going on, they found out at that time that he only had one kidney. And so he was pulled, and he did the same thing. He moved over to soccer and had to wear the flak jacket.
Okay, so this kid was missing a kidney already, and they just found out because he had back pain?
Well, yeah, during the game, he got hit. He got a blow back there, and so we started worrying about, you know, did he bruise his kidney, something going on with that, and sent him in to be evaluated. And in the course of the evaluation, they figured out that he only had one. They had no idea. I mean, if you think about it, none of the testing that we have would ever pick that up. You know, none of the normal physicals that we do, you know, they ask them, you know, are you missing one? Well, unless you run across a situation, you would have no idea. You know, you have no idea to check for that type of thing. You know, the same type of thing happened whenever my son was born. Whenever he was born, he had a condition, and they started checking him for spina bifida, and they said, well, you need to also check all of the children in his generation throughout the families. And so they did that, and come to find out that my niece, who was 8 at the time, she's just a skinny little girl, that found out that she already had 50% shut down in one kidney and 75% in another one. And if my son hadn't been born, that she wasn't having any problems, nothing. You know, the doctor said that really him being born with that physical deformity made it to where, you know, it saved her life, because somebody actually went and checked to see, hey, if this kid got any of these symptoms, or having any of these problems. And, you know, she had a little surgery. Everything is fine. And she's, you know, 100% all the way around now.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. What else? What other stories, strange things? I know I actually had a friend in high school get hit in football in the kidney, end up losing a kidney. He was in the hospital for quite a while. But so what other strange things, things that maybe you've only seen once, things that maybe if you were teaching a class, you would say, hey, look for this?
I'm trying to think what it was. After one of the hurricanes, we were playing, and my coworker, I won't tell you who it was to protect the guilty. So I was working the game by myself, and we had a defensive end that got hit right below the sternum, you know, right in the belly, and it kind of came off, and you know, he was in a great deal of pain. And while I was evaluating him, you know, of course, I tell him, all right, I'll be right back. And another kid had a concussion. So bring the kid with the concussion off. So I'm looking at him. And before I can get back to the first kid I was looking at, I notice he's back in the game. So it's the first, probably the only time I've ever stepped onto the field and to the side judge and go, okay, I have an injury timeout. I need that kid back on the, and so I called injury timeout, and I bring the kid that got hit in the belly off the field. And so I'm looking at him. By then, his abdomen is very rigid, and he's nauseated now. I get him over there, and I try to take his blood pressure, and his blood pressure is much lower than it was before. And so I send one of the student aides over to get the EMS, and they come over there, and now the concussion kid is, you know, going south on me. But it turns out they life-flighted the abdomen out because he started vomiting. He had actually had a rupture in his colon, and they life-flighted him downtown. And I have never seen that before or after. And he had a big midline incision. So, you know, as you never, you know, you never know. So,
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, yep. Got yelled at for stepping on the field, but I think it was worth it.
All right. So kind of going back to that, kid got hit hard in the stomach, came over complaining to you of stomach pains or shortness of breath or what?
Stomach pain.
And then at the initial evaluation, you just felt something was off. Was his stomach rigid?
His belly was tender. His point tender, but it wasn't rigid. And then he put himself back in the game when I looked at the other kid. And I was afraid he was going to get hit again. So
then after that, it kind of was getting the swelling going on, so it was rigid. And then
he was nauseated.
He was nausea, and blood pressure was dropping. And so, all right.
So, you know, I think, you know, kids take a blow to the stomach, you know, we're always worried about a spleen. Well, you really got to worry about the whole abdomen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. We had just on, you know, Thursdays, how the varsity will go out and, you know, they're kind of a little bit looser with what they're doing in practice. And they threw the ball up in the air, and the guy jumps up, and somebody bumps him a little bit, and he lands on the football, you know, and just, nobody really thought anything about it. He just, you know, kind of came back in, and, you know, he's getting ready to go home, and he comes by and says, gosh, I just can't quite catch my breath, you know. And did you get hit? No. Can't really find anything big that happened. And it was, you know, something as simple as, you know, that he just kind of tripped and fell on the football, but he wound up with a ruptured spleen also. So, I mean, sometimes even smaller things like that, like we were talking about, you know, being careful in the dugout, paying attention at all times, you know, is something that I try to stress to the student trainers also. You know, just because it's the last play of the game, don't start packing up everything, because, you know, we had that one year that, you know, stuck that kid in for the last play of the game, and they snapped the ball, and somebody dives into his knee, and, you know, 0-1, the gun goes off, and everybody's jumping up and down. We won, and they're running off the field, and nobody even notices that, you know, poor little Mike's out there rolling around with his knee, you know, he tore his MCL, and everybody's rolling, trying to roll stuff off. Nobody's noticing what's going on. I had seen him and gone out there, and I had a heck of a time trying to get, you know, somebody's attention, to get somebody to come over and help me out with the kids. So, you know, paying attention all the way through, and, you know, at all times, you just never know when something's going to happen.
I think also we have the responsibility not only for our coaches as well. And you know, I had an issue with a coach that became ill during a game. And we realized then that we don't have emergency contacts on our coaches. You know, now, you know, back then you could just open somebody's phone. Now they're locked. So I always want to know who to contact if a coach becomes ill or injured, because, you know, you need to let somebody know when it's a serious injury, you know, because, you know, they are under a very high stress situation when they're coaching. And, you know, you've got to be able to take care of them and know who to contact, you know, if you've had to transport them. So that's something that I've learned over the years as well.
So it's not something similar, it's related, but something that I've seen that I've only seen once, maybe twice, is someone have surgery for a plica syndrome in their knee.
Uh-huh.
And so that's one of those things we got to kind of look for if they're having pain right there in the around the patella. So it could be, you know, everything else is fine, but they keep having that pain, that swelling, that tenderness just there on the outside. And again, it was one of those things where we treat it. It's not getting any better. Okay, let's send you to the doctor.
Right.
And then the doctor's like, yeah, here's what I think it is. So we're going to, you know, do this rehab for this long. And if not, then we'll do surgery.
Right.
And so, again, I think that's something that is easily overlooked.
That and a Baker's cyst as well. Yeah, you see that. I'm trying to think of some other interesting stories here. I had a dislocated hip probably over 30 years ago that the physician reduced on the field. And I'm not sure you would do that nowadays, but I think that's something I'll never forget. Sound like a shotgun blast going off when it was reduced, you know. But, you know, over the years, we've changed a little bit in our medicine. But as we've talked about, it's all about listening, because most of the time they'll get around to telling you exactly what's wrong, you know, if you just listen.
All right, so tell me a little bit more about the hip dislocation. What is it?
You know, that was like actually my first year right out of college, and we were at a away game, and the kid just planted, and we got out there, and his leg was externally rotated, and coworker at the time and the physician, you know, were looking at it, and the physician decided, I guess because of the lack of pulse, distal pulse, that it had to be, you know, done there. And so a coworker laid across the player's chest on the field to stabilize him, and the physician, slight pressure, leaned back and put it back in place. I just remember, because, you know, I was right there. It just sounded so loud because it was so quiet at the field. But then they send the kid on for x-rays, you know. Kid went on. He didn't play that year, but he went on to play the next year, so... I thought that was, I've never seen that before on the field, something, you know, you always remember.
Yeah, I would think I would remember a dislocated hip. So it really just like a thump, like a boom?
It was more a loud thump.
When it was just sitting back in there.
Yeah.
Crazy. I know we had a student fracture a femur, and I saw EMS apply the traction and then the screaming, and then once it finally gets back to alignment or, you know, reduce whatever, then it's a lot more comfortable. But
right.
That was the first time I've seen a fractured femur.
Yes, and that can be very painful.
Yeah, we had one this year that the kid running back just comes around the corner, kind of open field, plant, goes to cut back, and somebody jumped on his back, and he hit the ground and started screaming. And, you know, everybody thought he had pulled a muscle or something. But again, you had that external, little bit of external rotation. And he mid-shaft snapped that thing, you know, did the same thing, you know, as far as, you know, got him immobilized, threw him in with EMS and took him off. And they got in there and said, yeah, you know, that's exactly, it was that femur fracture. But it was going back and looking, we've looked at the film, we've got, you know, from sideline, or, you know, we got so many different angles of video nowadays all the time, that we looked at it from different directions, and you never can see anything other than, you know, he's got his leg completely straightened out whenever somebody jumped on his back. So he just axial loaded that femur, and big strong kid, somehow he snapped it. and looking at it, it was not, you know, the type of a blow that you would expect. You know, you'd think a femur fracture, it's got to be some kind of big fall or, you know, motor vehicle or something like that. It was really kind of a freak type of situation.
And, does it seem we're having more femur fractures? Or is it just maybe, I don't know, it just seems like there's more happening. Are you seeing more, Thomas?
No, this is the first one that I'd seen on the field. Hmm. And we had a secretary that fell down some steps one day and did that. And then we all, had another teacher also that slipped on some steps, slipped on an orange peel. Not your typical, you know, slapstick slip on the banana peel type of guy. No, he's special. He slipped on an orange peel. And, you know, it was before school. He was outside doing morning duty and, you know, went over there and, oh, yeah, he snapped it. But yeah, I haven't really seen, you know, like I said, that was the first one on the field for me.
Yeah.
What other stories you guys got?
You know, we're old. It takes a while for us to think about it. With our 70 years of experience.
I've got another one that didn't actually happen to me. It happened to Dean Laird, who was the athletic trainer at the Broncos for 50, 60 years. I don't know. He was the trainer whenever Moses played for the Unicorns. And our defensive coordinator was a quarterback at the Broncos in the 80s. And he went to make a throw, and somebody came in. He caught a helmet to the humerus and snapped it. And Dean went out there to check him out and realized that he had that fracture and that he was starting to have contracture of the muscles. So he put his foot in his armpit, grabbed hold, and pulled back, applying traction, and then realized that nobody, he was the only person around. Nobody else, you know, the referees were off getting water. Both teams had gone to their benches to talk to their coaches. And so he's out there pulling, trying to keep, you know, the humerus from severing the artery. And he's just laying back. There's nobody around. So he starts, you know, yelling, trying to get some help. And I've heard the story from both him and from, like I said, our coach, who it was the guy who broke the arm. And, you know, both of them, you know, said, you know, they were sitting out there, and it seemed like forever before anybody ever realized that anything was going on. You know, they were that time frame, whenever something big happens like that, and all of a sudden you realize, hey, how in the world am I going to communicate? You know, how can I get some help over here? Time goes real slow.
Wow.
We had an athlete ended up with a collapsed lung. He got hit in the rib, and there was a doctor on the sideline, and, you know, he listened and he's like, all right, you know, sounds good. If it keeps hurting you, then you want to go to the hospital and get an x-ray tomorrow or something like that. And then end up that night going to the hospital, inability to breathe. And, you know, that's one of those things. It's like, we were there, we checked him. We didn't say, no, you're okay. We didn't say, suck it up. We checked him. The doctor told us this and ended up, you know, going downhill from there. But that's why I try to always say, you know, it's not going to hurt my feelings if you go to the doctor. It's not going to, you know, offend me if you decide to go get x-rays. You may sit and wait for a long time, but it's not going to hurt my feelings. So I try to let them know that it's okay if they want to go to the doctor to go. But that was a kind of a crazy situation. He was in the hospital for a couple of days.
Yeah. I think some of the most eye-opening injuries I've ever seen is when I worked with Justin Sports Medicine at the Houston Rodeo. And my athletes didn't really have a great appreciation because, you know, you see those injuries and you come back to school and go, yeah, you know, those are some of the most, the pain threshold of the professional rodeo athlete, including the barrel racers, is unbelievable. And, you know, they don't perform. They don't make any money. And so my eyes were really open to the trauma that they sustain and the injuries that, you know, we saw. I did that for 10 years, and it was unbelievable. Had a great appreciation for the, you know, what their bodies go through and when they, you know, they may be only, and only be 8 seconds or whatever else, but it's unbelievable. But one injury I remember, and it was an injury that occurred at a previous rodeo in Houston, you know, as one of the best healthcare systems for when they get here. So they, you know, the rodeo, professional rodeos know, cowboys and cowgirls know if they, when they get here, they can get medical care. So we were in the rodeo. We were in the training room one day before rodeo, and now Houston Methodist and the rodeo sports medicine committee taking care of it. But back then it was just in sports medicine. So we had two physicians, we had a massage therapist, and I think four or five athletic trainers working. So I was in the training room that night, and a woman came in. She was a barrel racer, and she'd gotten hurt at a rodeo a couple weeks before. And I was in there with a physician, and she walked in and she said, you know, I got hurt, you know, and I need somebody to look at my leg. And she pulled her pants leg up, and the physician looked at me, and he looked back at the woman, and he goes, what'd you do to your leg? And she goes, well, I hit a barrel, and she had gangrene, and it hadn't been taken care of. You know, she didn't have any health insurance. And he goes, man, we got to get you to the hospital. And I got her to the hospital. They treated her, and he was really afraid she was going to lose her leg. And they did a hyperbaric chamber and they, you know, IV antibiotics, but they were able to save her leg. But, you know, it's just, you know, you wouldn't think just hitting a barrel, but, you know, and physician I went on to talk about this, he said, you know, you think about it, there is feces from the horses, you know, the dirt, because they roll it. He goes, you know, that gets into an open wound. He goes, that is just a bacteria superhighway there. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of injuries that we saw. And the other thing about working the rodeo is unlike any other sport, is, you know, we have to worry about, we can't enter to look at an athlete until the animals are gone. And there is a veterinarian right there. So they take care of the, sometimes an animal is hurt as well as the athlete. So, and you got to make sure you don't get hurt while the animals are still in there. So it is a very unique experience that I learned a great deal. But, oh, yeah, that could be a show in itself. And I know that you've had Jace on here, Jace Duke, and
Sean,
yes. So it's amazing.
Before we move on from that, if you've never been to rodeo, I'm not a cowboy. I was wearing the cowboy hat that Sean loaned me when I was out there, so I'm definitely a poser cowboy, but but the things you see and learn out there are crazy. I mean, you know, a guy's knocked unconscious, but you have to wait for the bull to be cleared. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you just get the experience to volunteer at the rodeo, you get to learn a lot real quick. Mm-hmm. And so I would definitely hit up Sean Reedy if he's doing one of the ones for Justin Sports Medicine, and he goes almost all across the United States, you know, Utah, everything. So hit him up and see if you can volunteer with him somewhere, because you can learn a lot real quick.
Well, you can, and people are. I have a great deal of respect for animals. Obviously, I grew up in a small town, and we had cattle when I was growing up. But they have top-notch veterinarians that are right there by the arena, and they get the same care. You know, they're taken care of just like the athletes are. So. I just want to say that was one of the best experiences of my life, is to be able to take care of, and they are some of the nicest people you ever want to be around. And some of them, I'm glad that I learned to tape ACLs in college, because we didn't have derotational braces or anything else. But because I got to use that again, is taping an ACL, you know, with Elasticon. But some of those guys can tape themselves faster mm-hmm. than I could tape them, because a lot of places there's no athletic trainers. And I will tell you that the people call them rodeo clowns, and they're not. They're actually bullfighters. Mm-hmm. And those men are unbelievable, because they save a lot of lives. But when they come in and they put on their gear, they look like they're wearing an alert catalog, because they have on every kind of brace you can imagine. What they do is really important. I know they dress like clowns, but they do save a lot of lives. And they protect those cowboys, the bull riders especially. It is an experience to be so close to where the action is. But anyway, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent, but that those injuries that you see there are unbelievable.
All right, I think we got time for one more story. Thomas, Kathy, we got one more story.
I'll yield to Thomas.
I've got one that we're social media and movies and everything like that. The kids pick up a lot of things from that. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But we had this one kid that dislocated his shoulder, and heard him kind of scream and started going over that direction. And he takes off running for the sidelines on our practice field. We had all these oak trees around the practice field, and he takes off running and runs, and he's screaming, and he runs and wham, runs into the tree. And I thought he was just in a bunch of pain or something, you know, that, you know, that he was kind of blinded by the pain. He didn't see what, didn't really know what he was doing. But I go over there and I roll him over and I said, Glenn, what are you Mel doing? Yeah, what's going on? He said, well, I saw Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon. You know, he dislocated his shoulder and I was just trying to do that. And I said, well, Glenn, that's the movies. And how many times have you broken that collarbone on that side? Three times. How many times have you broken the one on the other side? Twice. I said, I would stay away from trees if I were you.
Okay, so did it relocate?
Oh, no. Okay. No, he knocked himself silly. That's about it. Yeah. It was, looking back, we had no idea what in the world he was trying to do. But, oh, yeah, it made complete sense that, you know, if Mel Gibson can do it, well, I can too, you know. He said he wasn't in pain, but, you know, Mel Gibson was screaming whenever he would do it. He would scream and, you know, throw that shoulder in right quick into the 2x4 or whatever like that in the side of the wall or whatever. So he was screaming, you know, because that's what you're supposed to do.
That must be the secret to Smithson Valley's football success.
Yeah, we got guys who are dumb enough to run into trees. That's it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That is definitely a story to end on. I'm not sure. I'm literally tearing up over here. I can just imagine what seeing that picture over. Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. I'm going to be at NATA at the Dragonfly Max booth. Kathy just told me she's going to join me. She's going to be co-hosting some. So if you're going to be at NATA in New Orleans 2018, then come by, check us out. If you're part of one of the interviews or if you, you know, help bring us a guest to be interviewed, we'll have some t-shirts there that'll say I was on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I know Kathy got one last year for helping us out interview Rex Jones, right? You got one, right? You got a shirt?
We'll talk about that.
Oh, okay. Uh-oh. Well, then I'll make sure I save you one.
I'll send it to Mr. Petmecki.
All right. So check us out there at the Dragonfly Max booth, NATA, New Orleans. Kathy, someone wants to get a hold of you. I have your Twitter here is at Kathy Shupa.
Shupak.
See, we practiced it before.
I know we practiced it. See, Shupak.
Shupak. Like Tupac. That's what she told me. She said, like Tupac. But Kathy Shupak. So Kathy, S-U-P-A-K. Again, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/case-studies. Kathy. And then I also have Thomas's email here. Thomas, is that the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't do any Twitter or anything like that.
Thomas, if you ever happen to have another kid run into a tree, please have it on video because I really want to see it.
Well, they've cut down most of the trees in our area here now. So,
all right. Well, it is.
That's why we haven't done as well the last couple of years, you know.
Yeah. It has been a pleasure talking with Kathy and Thomas. Rob from Frio Hydration is going to be joining me as my co-host on the Sports Medicine Broadcast while we're at NATA. So look forward to spending that time with there, hanging out. We're going to have a good time there at the Dragonfly Max booth, me and Rob, and then several other volunteers, like Kathy said or Bubba said, they'll come out and help out. So I look forward to sharing the stage with you guys and then meeting anybody that is willing to come up and talk to us in person. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/case-studies. For Jeremy, Thomas, Kathy, that is a wrap. Thanks, guys.